Okay. First of all, it's absolutely awesome to see the Beit Midrash fill. It's been a while, I think, since before COVID that we got it to be this full, and this is wonderful. And I really appreciate everyone coming. I want to acknowledge up front that I know that the topic of these 4 weeks is intensely personal and matters deeply to people directly, for their children, for their friends, and things like that. So I want to start with a brief introduction in that regard. This is the first night program of the 2023 Summer Beit Midrash of the Center for Modern Torah Leadership. And the Center for Modern Torah Leadership's motto is taking responsibility for Torah. And what we meant by that when we began was a recognition that one has to be aware every time one has a conversation in the Beit Midrash that it has impact on real people. You can't say we're just having the conversation in the Beit Midrash without regard for its effects on people. At the same time, that there can't be aspects of the real world that one refuses to have conversations about in the Beit Midrash. And the conversation in the Beit Midrash has to actually be about Torah and not simply about using Torah to get to a predetermined result. So what we're going to try to model in these 4 weeks is precisely that kind of conversation, one which is aware and sensitive of the real-world impacts, but which does not censor Torah. There are things that may be hard to read. We'll read them. And in which the conversation about Torah has to be about Torah and not just about whether Torah can help us achieve what we want. At the end, in the fourth shiur, we'll have a conversation, at least the beginnings of a conversation, about how we translate Torah into practical halakha, the beginning of a conversation. But I want to set those two rules for the conversation at the outset. What we're going to be doing mostly is saying, look, this is what a text says. Let's think about what this text means. And in our heads, we have to be thinking about that. If this text means that, what would it matter for the issue that we're really addressing? Right? And I labeled it, the topic of the entire series is transitions. But we should be aware that at least in the first week, the conversation about the text in terms of the text themselves could probably happen without any reference to trans persons at all. It's probably not within the cultural imagination of many of the interpreters, the original interpreters of these texts. So it's our job afterwards to think about, well, what they talked about, how does that relate to what our issues are? And then there are all sorts of choices that have to be made after we interpret the texts. First of all, when you have multiple options, many, many options as to how to continue the lines of the traditional texts, which do you choose? So deciding that a particular text stands for exactly what you want might be counterproductive, because it might be that you've identified this text stands for exactly the outcome I want to achieve, and the next text you read says, and we don't paskin that way. And then you've tied yourself to the wrong, right, to the wrong horse. Right? So we want to be very careful not to move from text to halakha before we absolutely have to, but to be aware that right, that we're not talking about pure abstractions. So I thought perhaps the safest way to begin the conversation, in a certain sense, was about Deborah Sampson. Right, we asked the question, right, if Deborah Sampson were Jewish and Deborah Sampson came to Rabbi Chassis and said, excuse me, I would like to serve in the Revolutionary Army, but they won't let me in as long, right, if I'm dressed as a woman, can I dress as a man for the next several years in order to serve in the Revolutionary Army? What would the halachic response be? Okay, right, that's an interesting question, right? That, which, forces us to think about the issue in a context other than which we usually do. There are ways in which you might say, well, it's obvious that this is totally different because you're engaged in a, in a struggle which we believe in, and anything you do for that. And we talk about Ya'el in Chumash, where we allow all sorts of sins in the context of war so that people can participate. Or we could say, hang on a sec, there are rabbinic interpreters who say Lo yekli gever al isha specifically means do not have women wear weapons or military fatigues. So, right, you can make Deborah Sampson the best or the worst. So I want to put that on the table, right? So if you need a, we need a cutout to address, right, how the issue is, right, what the practical implications are, right, because we need a way to separate ourselves in the short term from the real world implications. So one way to accomplish that is to think about how would this affect our answer to Deborah Sampson, if she came and asked the question. And afterwards, we can decide whether we should take down the statue or not. Now, part of the difficulty with the issue, I think, is also presented in the cool illustration on the front page, where it seems as if nobody can tell whether this is a picture of Deborah Sampson dressed as a woman or dressed as a man. Right, so that raises some of the part of the challenges of what exactly is involved in the in the prohibition. Right, so I thought that was also a useful phrase there. Right, there's a Britannica says that it's Deborah Sampson disguised as a male soldier, but the U.S. Army site says that it's Deborah Sampson delivering the letter which she knows will lead to her discharge because she's already been outed. Right, so apparently some people think this is a portrait of her dress as a man, and some people think it's a portrait of her already fully known as a woman. Okay, and that's because fashion has changed over time. And right, you know, it's right. So that's a whole challenge in its own right. Okay, that's for the introduction. Let's now turn to the explicit Torah sources. We're on page 2. So the first, in the second story, in the first story of creation, chapter 1 of Bereshit, we have no mention of clothes. In the second story of creation, the Garden of Eden story, there are two sets of clothes. There are the clothes that Adam and Chava make for themselves, which are fig leaves. And so we talked about in Shir, whether if you were assigned the task of painting over the unfortunate exposures in the Vatican, in various famous medieval paintings, as a halachist, would you wish to paint the fig leaves differently on Adam and Eve? All right, or can you use standard issue fig leaves that you can do, or decals that you can just paste over the appropriate parts without making them distinctively male and female fig leaves? Right, those are the first clothing, the clothing they make for themselves, and then God makes them clothing. And God makes the text of it is Vayas Hashem Elokim LeAdam Lishto Kasnos or Vayalbishen. So he made them kusnos. Kusnos is an odd formulation. It may or may not be the same thing as kutanot, which seems to be some kind of robe garment. But the clear implication of the verse seems is that God made Adam and Eve identical copies, right? Identical clothes. He made each of them kutanot. So that's an interesting notion, right? Why doesn't God invent distinctive masculine and feminine fashion the first time? Right, the first time he makes clothes. So I gave you one, you know, I think which is sort of entertaining. The work called the Chanukat HaBayit, which we'll just do for the, you know, for the pause, which is written by Abraham Joshua Heschel in the 17th century, because Abraham Joshua Heschel was the Abraham Joshua Heschel of America in the 20th century was the latest in a long line of Abraham Joshua Heschels, after which he was named, of which one of the early famous ones is the 17th century, Abraham Joshua Heschel of Krakow. And he does a fascinating thing. There is a genre called the Midrashei Pliya. Midrashei Pliya are interpretations of Chumash that one makes up and attributes to Chazal, so that you can then interpret them. It's an interesting genre that goes on throughout Jewish history. There are collections of them, and there are certain famous ones. This I have from Professor Schneier Lyman, you can believe it or not, but probably the most famous one is in the introduction to the Ein Yaakov. He tells you that while the Talmud has two famous positions as to which the most famous verse in the Torah is, one of them is V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, right? You should love your neighbor as yourself, you all know that one. The second one is Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam, right? This is the book of the generations of human beings. People like that one also, right? That one seems perhaps more general. But he says there's a third position, and the third position is Et HaKeves HaRishon Taseh BaBoker. You should bring the first lamb of the Korban Tamid in the morning. That is the greatest pasuk in the Torah. And his whole introduction is explaining why that is the greatest pasuk in the Torah. But nobody before ever thought it was the greatest pasuk of the Torah. It was just a cool idea to try, right? A cool thought experiment. What if somebody made the claim that sacrifices were more important than interpersonal things? Okay, so here the Chanukah Bayit opens, right? Rabbi Heschel opens with an interesting claim that he claims that there is a statement, a prior statement, which says that we derive from this verse that God made them both these robes, that Adam and Chava were alone in the world. To which we can say, A, what is making them, I would think the other way around, right? He made them close. That must mean there are other people there for them to feel shame about, A. And B, didn't we already, if not, didn't we already know they were alone in the world? Why do I need this verse to teach me that they were alone in the world? So his answer is that the reason this verse teaches us that they were alone in the world is that unisex garments are ordinarily prohibited, but they're only prohibited because we're afraid that people will be able to pass as the other gender and thereby sneak into the other gender's segregated space in order to have sexual liaisons. And therefore, since Adam and Chava were the only people in the world, and they could not masquerade, right? They could not masquerade as the other sex in any convincing way, therefore they could have unisex clothing. And so since God made them unisex clothing, that proves that they were alone in the world. Now, is there any, right? Interesting question to me is, why does he feel so interested? Why does he feel compelled to make up this thought experiment, to yield that result? And a second really interesting thing about it is that it rests on not only on a premise that is not precedented in prior interpretation, it also rests on a premise that seems to be halachically almost universally rejected, which is that unisex clothing is forbidden. Actually, the halachic consensus is that unisex clothing is perfectly permitted. And the model for that is a story found on Nidarim, which you have on your source sheet, which says that Rabbi Yehuda's wife, Rabbi Yehuda apparently was very poor, and his wife once went out and collected wool in the marketplace and made some kind of cloak, possibly a talit. And when she went out to the marketplace, she would wear it. And when he went out to the marketplace, he would wear it. So Rabbi Yehuda and his wife shared a single garment. And the context of the story seems to suggest that this was their only garment. They were impoverished. And so they wore this garment even on socially inappropriate occasions. So that seems to be a demonstration that that unisex clothing is permitted. And most sources I've seen take this as a given. So it's an interesting question as to why Rabbi Heschel develops an interpretation that, right, that is creative, and then his answer to it, his explanation of it, rests on a halachic premise that seems to be false, just to yield this interesting result that that the prohibition against cross-dressing only applies once Adam and Chava have to relate to gender performance in terms of lots of people, right, in terms of standing for something as opposed to just about themselves. Right, so that's a really interesting place for him to go. Yes, Gabe.
Meaning, this might be jumping ahead a little bit, but he's getting the licentiousness from Rashi, no?
He's getting
the idea that cross-dressing leads to some kind of sexual immorality. That's part is founded.
Yeah, that he has, but it's an interesting thought experiment. He seems to be cementing that, right? That if you're the only man in the world and you're the only woman in the world, then there is no need to have sexual distinctiveness at all. Right? It's only because you're performing in community. Right? That's right. That's right. That's what he seems to be emphasizing. It's an interesting claim. It's certainly an interesting claim. Now, part of what interests me though is the other way as well. Is that why do people think this story is compelling? I had a really simple way of getting out of this Gemara. Anybody say, tell me, what's the simple way? Read this Gemara of Yudin and his wife shared a garment. Why does that not prove anything about unisex garments? Yes?
It was a time of need.
Time of need. Okay, we can say that was an extraordinary circumstance, but I think there's an even more basic answer than that. Yes, Roger?
They wore them
differently. Yeah. Right? I have a robe. Right, and which doesn't have any kind of buttons or anything like that to tell you. So if you wear it right, wear it with the right over the left, right, then it's one gender. If you wear the left or the right, it's the other gender. Here we're just talking probably about a square piece of cloth, like a toga. I'm sure there are distinctive ways of male and female ways of wearing togas. Why don't we just resolve it that way? So it's really interesting to me that, so far as I can tell, nobody suggests that. They take the Gemara at face value that the fact that they now it could be. That if we're going to be very conceptual yeshiva students, we'll say, aha, so it tells you that it's just a din in the article of clothing and has nothing to do with the effect of the article of clothing on your appearance. Right, that's how they understood the Torah. But that seems like, you know, that would be a fascinating thing in its own right to say that men can't wear women's clothing and women can't wear men's clothing, but there's no reason that men and women need to look distinctive at all. Right? That would be a very interesting result. Yes, Mark?
So that same logic applies to Adam and Eve. Same garments were worn differently.
Same garments. Clear, could also have been, right? Could also have been worn differently. Although there, like, the verse seems to be going out of its way. Right? You know, it could have said that God made Adam a three-piece suit, and Chava a ball gown. Right? He doesn't. He said he made them katnot, which is not just clothes, but just that he made them begadim. Right? But katnot seem to be a particular kind of garment that dafka functions. Like we know that both the Kohanim wear katnot, and Tamar, the daughter of David HaMelech, wears a kutonet. Right? So a kutonet seems to be dafka, a garment that can be worn both by men and women, although I'm sure it has adaptations that mark it distinctively as male or female. Yes?
To me, they were the only people in the world, so there's no context for anything. Anything that you're saying, there's nothing to be learned out because there's no context.
Well, no, because I could say easily, right, if I wanted to, I could have said that the job of Adam was to be masculine, and the job of Chava was to be feminine.
But how would they even know what that meant?
How would they even know what that meant? Okay, so the interesting thought experiment is that, you know, that maybe we should just say, you know what, all this is the equivalent of them not knowing, right, not knowing they were naked. Right? At first they didn't know they were naked, right? They had no context for that. And the next stage is they didn't, right? They knew they were naked, but they didn't know they were masculine or feminine. And right, we'll have to get to another story, right? You know, and the point of it is that this is early in the story, right? That could be. Then we'd have to look for some place later, right? Where they discover that, and that would be a very interesting thing to look for in Bereishis, right? To see, right, at what point in Bereishis, if ever, is there a discovery of masculinity and femininity? Yes, Tyke.
Perhaps another complexity is that gender expression of clothing is very much social. Perhaps this is what we missed. For example, in the 1890s, the fedora, the hat worn by all clergy men, was a female hat, woman's riding hat, designed for women specifically. And if you were wearing a fedora, you would look like a woman. Today, the fedora is a very masculine garment, certainly in Jewish society. What it means to have gender expression in clothing, and perhaps indeed whether there is a gender expression in clothing at all, is very socially defined.
Okay, right. So it could be that, again, that's what Roy said. They have no context at all. But the question is, when you write about it, then it's just, you know, then he would just say, okay, so it's uninteresting then. And we shouldn't bother talking about that case. Right? But the author of this text bothers making us think about that case. I'm wondering why. Right? Why is it worth his time to invent a midrash to make us think about this case if, in fact, the case tells us nothing at all? Okay, I also pointed out, right, that the verse which establishes the prohibition, which we'll move to next, uses the word gever. And the word gever is interesting because it really only appears in, we're assuming in context, that a gever is not a rooster, but a male human being. Although it can in later Hebrew mean a rooster. But the question is, why do we use this verse? Why do we use this term, gever, specifically in the context of the prohibition for male human being? The only other place you have in Chumash where Gever is used for that is in Bilam's self-description. And interesting to me that Bilam's self-description is always as a Gever with a disability. That's interesting. So Suma Ayin. If you understand it that way. And the Gever can also be vocalized Gibor. We really have only have one, the Giborim in Bereishis. The Gibor is Nimrod. So it's interesting, right? It's not obvious that there is a full-throated endorsement of. Pardon?
Gever is used in Tanakh.
Yes, it's used later in Tanakh, right? So we could try and we can plug it back. I don't know if it's going to change that much, but yes. Okay, that's what we have in the way of background. Now let's get to the meat of it. Okay, so in Dvarim we have a verse which says, "Lo yech li gever alisha, lo yilbash gever simlat isha." So on the one hand, there's a parallelism where it sounds like, you know, we can say, well, there's a prohibition against a woman. And we have to get thinking, every term for gender is fraught. We should understand that. But we're going to translate Isha as woman, although, of course, it can also mean wife. And we have to figure out choices. Why does it say it? When does it say Adam? When does it say Ish? When does it say Enosh? When does it say Gever? When does it say Av? When does it say Ben? When does it say Zachar? Right, all different terms for male human beings. And conversely, we have lots of different terms for female human being, many of which are used in the first several Prakim of Bereshit. And I think like one thing to get immediately is that Adam meets Chava, and he says, therefore, a man will leave his father and mother, even though he had no father and mother. So there are moments where Adam in Bereshit recognizes concepts of masculine and feminine, obviously, and sees them as central. Okay, so a chli gever should not be on a woman, and a gever should not wear the simla of a woman. So one of the questions that we have to ask all the way through is this intended to create some kind of difference between the prohibitions for men and the prohibitions for women? And this is an issue in, I think, throughout all discussions of halakha and all aspects of gender, sex, orientation, things like that, that we tend to try to flatten the position. We tend to make everything egalitarian and say that everything is flippable. Not necessarily. There might be very different prohibition, right? The nature of the prohibition of masculine adopting the feminine and feminine adopting the masculine might be wholly different. Although I will telegraph up front that, to my knowledge, the mainstream of halakha, and I'm still looking for cooler exceptions, assume that actually the prohibition is symmetric. What the content of that is, but they assume that they don't tend to argue this is distinctive in terms of what men should do for women, can't do in terms of women, what women can't do in terms of men. It's an interesting lost opportunity in terms of careful reading of the verse, and I'm not sure why it is. Okay, then I have a highly challenging statement. Whenever you have the word toiva, obviously in all contexts, raises challenges. And it says, ki toivat Hashem Elokecha kol osei eleh. So I want to confront it up front. I'm not going to pretend that the word toiva doesn't mean something serious, although what it means is not clear. But the interesting thing here, right, that's why it's safe, I guess, to bring it up to start with, is that Rashi immediately goes out of his way and says, don't think that just cross-dressing is toiva. And he reads the verse in a way that is really quite astonishing. A simple translation of the verse would have been, because anybody who does these things, any woman who has a kli gever upon her, or any man who has the simla of a woman upon him, is a toiva. That's what kol osei, right? Kol osei ele is. And Rashi says, no, it doesn't mean that at all. Rashi says, ki toavat lo asra Torah el levush hamevili de toiva. The Torah, right, toiva is a qualifier. The Torah only forbids these things when they lead to toiva. Now, that's a very conscious interpretational choice. Right, it would be very easy to read the verse as saying that doing these things is a toiva, and it doesn't. Now, to figure out what toiva does it lead to. That's a challenge in its own right. But I think if up front, just notice that's what Rashi says. And Rashi, all the way through, he says, right, that the accoutrement, that's just because I wanted to use that word, of a man must not be the woman. And it's not really clear what kli, if I said the utensil of a man, what would that mean? So not at all clear what a kli gever is, right? So the something associated with a gever should not be on a woman. So Rashi says that means so as, right, and he has a triple causality thing, right? Why should the accoutrement of a man not be on a woman? We're on page 3 now. So as to appear like a man. So the first thing is, what's prohibited is things that make a woman appear like a man. Second, so as to walk among the men. The reason that it's prohibited for women to do things that make them look like men is because that way they will sneak into the segregated female male spaces, which otherwise women would have no access, and vice versa. So that's a whole interesting thing, you know, in this base medrash. Right here we have like a really pretty co-ed base medrash. What do you do in a society where those spaces are very, very limited? And generally, the purpose of passing has nothing to do with the attempt to sneak into spaces that are single-gendered, because spaces, for better or worse, spaces that are single-gendered are vanishing. Right? It might be, you know, that the last place left is shul, which hopefully is not yet a place of assignations, such that people want to sneak into shul for that purpose, although you can read John Donne's autobiography and know that that was not always the case with houses of worship. Bathhouses, okay. Bathhouses might still bathrooms, right? So, bathrooms here we are, right? Very contemporary. Okay, very good, right? But we may end up with a world where all bathrooms are a single person, right? And unisex, right? You can imagine a world like that. So, I don't know. Okay, but maybe that's it, right? Maybe that's the right. So, this A, to change your appearance, to change your gender appearance, or to change your sex appearance, if you want, right? Because so as to welcome men, because this is only for the sake of adultery. So three stages. A, to appear like a man, so as to go among the men, so as to engage in adultery. You could say niyuf, not doesn't necessarily mean adultery. Maybe it's just a term for all sorts of illegitimate sexuality, so we haven't gotten all unmarried women out of the prohibition yet. Right, because you can't commit adultery unless you're married. But three, so now whenever we have a law, we have to ask, okay, if this is defined as the purpose of the law, so we have two choices. We can say, and therefore, whenever that is not the purpose of your action, you're fine. Whenever that is not a plausible end of your action, you're fine. Or we forbid everything because we think that it's bad socially to allow this ever because it could lead to this. Right? So saying that the purpose of the prohibition is so that you not look like a man, so that you won't go into single gender spaces, so that you won't commit it, right? So you won't commit adultery could mean, and so therefore it's fine if A, your appearance remains distinctive. But interesting question then, right? If that's really our goal, is for the appearance to be distinctive, why do we allow you unisex clothing? Right, because you can sneak in just as easily, right, in unisex clothing as you can, right, as you can by dressing up entirely as the right as the other sex. Yes.
I would say that often if someone who's a male is dressed in unisex clothing, it's generally going to be gendered as a masculine. And if a woman is wearing unisex clothing, they generally tend to be.
So you think that people, right, it's because body types are distinctive, that, right, that it takes, it right, unisex clothing doesn't actually disguise. That could be true, certainly depending on the person. Okay. So it's only prohibited if you're distinctive. What if you're distinctive, but you make sure that you only wear such clothing in public spaces that are not gendered, or in public spaces where seclusion is impossible. Right? You're very, very makbid on yichud when doing things like this. So it could be, okay, then you're not in the scope of the prohibition, or it could be, no, the whole point is that we dislike all these things because they break down social barriers. Right? So even if we were to concede this is the exclusive purpose of the law, it tells us, it does not tell us anything about what the end halakha will be. And furthermore, we can also make distinctions between Deoraita and Rabbanan law. We can say, okay, this tells us the scope of the Deoraita law, but doesn't tell us the scope of the Rabbanan law. On the other hand, if we really make this distinction between Deoraita and Rabbanan, so there always, or almost always, is more room to allow exceptions in individual circumstances, in hardship cases and things like that, for rabbinic law as opposed to biblical law. So it makes a big difference to us, right, what ends up being biblical and what ends up being rabbinic. Okay, right. That's where we are in Rashi. That's our setup, and now I want to get to the sugya that I think is central to really all halakhic conversations. Right, I wanted to begin by setting this up so that we could understand that there are ways to understand the text which essentially make this entirely as an attempt to control certain kinds of sexual behavior. Nothing to do with masculinity and femininity. Nothing to do with individual identity, entirely about social control of sexuality, and that would open much more space for leniency on a social level if you think that the rationale is controlling on a biblical level, and on an individual level if you think the rationale is controlling both biblically and rabbinically, and on an individual level if you think the rationale is controlling biblically but not rabbinically. But I don't want to pretend that that's obviously the way the tradition goes. I just want to open that possibility so that we can be aware of it. The conversation actually stems, the core of the conversation where Rashi is coming from, but let's also be aware that we're talking about Rashi as a commentary in Chumash, not Rashi as a halachist. And that Rashi adopts this as, right, in his commentary in Chumash does not mean that he thinks that his understanding of halacha is limited to that. It just means he thinks that's the best explanation to give of the text in an interpretational context. Yes, David? Or just holding it? Pardon? Oh, sorry, Mike. Okay, fine. Okay, so, here's the text, right? So the Gemara in Nazir, we're on page 4 now, quotes a statement of Rechia Ba'aba, the name of Rabbi Yochanan, who says that one, here it means a male. I put another text on somewhere else, which I thought was useful just for propaganda purposes. But we'll get to it where the Talmud says Adam, and the Halakha says, no, right, the Talmud itself says, what we mean by Adam is women. Right, so you should know there's at least one place in the Talmud where the standard human being is female. But here it says one is probably referring to men. Somebody who removes underarm or groin hair gets lashes, right, is flogged. Okay, why would you get flogged for removing underarm or groin hair? This is not one of the places where there's a prohibition against using a razor per se. Although, interestingly enough, the distinction between razor and scissors gets brought in halachically. So we'll see in the context, right, that it seems like that removing certain kinds of body hair in certain kinds of societies is violates the prohibition in Dvarim 22:5 against a woman wearing a kli gever, or in this case, a man wearing a simlat isha, which means that up front, what we're doing is we have just broadened the prohibition massively. It's not about clothing anymore. And it goes, pardon?
Not only about clothing.
Exactly right. It's not only, right? It's not, right? It's not only about clothing anymore at all. And you also, you know, discuss the question of, it's not necessarily even about public presentation anymore, because why would anyone know whether you remove this hair, right, in any kind of public setting? So Rechia Bar Abba says in the name of Yochanan that a man who removes underarm or groin hair is flogged. The Gemara challenges him. The Gemara says removal of hair is not based on Torah words, but rather on Divrei Sofrim, meaning that, right, Divrei Sofrim is an ambiguous term. Let's assume here that it's a proxy for this is rabbinic, not Dioraita. So the attack on this statement is, you said that he's flogged. That implies this is a biblical violation, but really it's only rabbinic violation. So that could mean that it's claiming that maybe the biblical violation relates only to clothing, and it's a rabbinic violation when we move off of clothing. So the Gemara answer is, yeah, even when he said he was flogged, he also meant just rabbinic lashes, because you can also get lashes for violating rabbinic, right? So we might end up at this stage saying, you know what, there's a biblical violation about clothing, there's a rabbinic violation which includes, right, about body alterations, but the problem is how extensive is this, because it's very hard to believe that the rabbinic alteration is only about appearance. But we could say, okay, it's about appearance in bathhouses, right? Since we're talking about single gender spaces, so single gender spaces might very well be spaces where there's much less clothing. And so, right, and so removing body hair is a way in which you can pass in partially dressed environments. Okay, but then it's the second version. There's a somewhat different version, which Rechia Bar Abba, the name of Rabbi Yochanan, says, one who removes underarm or groin hair is flogged under the rubric of a gefer must not wear a win simla. So here it's obviously a biblical violation. We're not going to be able to get out of it by saying it's only a rabbinic violation, because he says explicitly there's a verse. So the Gemara says, hang on a sec, that contradicts the same Braita, which said it's only divrei sofrim. And the Gemara says, you know what? That's a dispute. It's actually a Tanaic dispute. Some people say that removal of body hair is rabbinic, and some people say that removal of body hair is biblical. If you say the removal of body hair is biblical, so now we've expanded the biblical prohibition, right, beyond clothing, and certainly beyond public appearance. So that would lead to much less space, probably. And then we go further. So the Gemara says, hang on a sec. The person who said that it's, right, who said that it's only rabbinic to remove underarm hair, what does he do with the verse, a gever must not wear the simla of an isha? Now that's an absurd question. What he says is he bans clothing. Right? So why are we asking this question? What does he do with the verse? So the answer seems to be that everyone understands that the verse is not exclusively about, or not directly about clothing. Everyone understands that the verse in some way is about a relationship between clothing and the word toiva. And the question is, how do we understand that relationship? So here, the Gemara says that that position, which says that removal of underarm hair is only a rabbinic prohibition, is connected to one of the sides in the following braita. But there are two sides in that braita, so you have to figure out, or I should say really, it's connected to at least one of the sides in the following braita. And we need to try to understand, right, which of the sides and why. So here's the braita. Braita says the following. A gever must not wear. What does this come to teach? Right, again, what kind of question is that? It comes to teach that a gever should not wear. The answer is, it teaches, right, if to teach that a man must not wear a woman's simla, and a woman must not wear a man's simla, here we've gotten rid of the whole notion of kli gever, right? It's an exactly parallel prohibition. But the verse says, it is a toeva, and there is no toeva here. So it can't just be that it's coming to prohibit cross-dressing, because why would we care? That's a really amazing statement. I don't know anything else in rabbinic literature like that, right? Where the verse says it's toivat, and we don't understand. And why would we call this that? Really interesting claim. Therefore, rather it must be that a man must not wear a woman's simla and sit amongst the women, or a woman wear a man's simla and sit amongst the men. Rashi, out of concern, lest that creates an occasion for yichud and therefore an occasion for sexual immorality. So that's the position we saw as Rashi. Right, the prohibition is completely aimed at trying to foster an environment in which sexual immorality is less likely. And then we can talk about in what societies, what things are necessary to accomplish that, and what happens if people's motives are different. Do we care about motives or do we care about results? And how precisely do we care about results? But Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, from where in scripture do we know that a woman should not go out with weapons to war, or right wearing weapons? Right, all depends how we frame it, right? But so the language has been minayin shelo teitzei isha bichlei zayin lamilchama. How do we know the woman should not go out with weapons? Let's say weapons, right? So we've replaced kli gever with kli zayin to war, because the verse says lo yek kli gever al isha. And how do we know that men should not probably like wear makeup, because it says that Yilbash Gever Simlat Isha. So Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov so now we're trying to know, what do we do with the relationship between the prohibition against cross-dressing and the concept of toeva? So the first Tana says we use it to radically limit the prohibition. Right, we say that even for clothing, really the prohibition isn't about clothing. And it's not about self-identity or gender performance or anything like that. It's all about trying to avoid things that will lead to mixed dancing. Mm-hmm. Okay? But Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, no, that's not what we learn from it. We learn from it is that we have to broaden the prohibition. That it's not just about clothing. And probably the simplest way of saying it is that the position which says that removal of underarm hair is only rabbinic, so that's the position which says that the essential biblical prohibition is only about clothing. But the position that says removal of underarm and groin hair is biblical says, and it's not just about bodies either. It's about, right, it's about all sorts of things. Now, how does this connect to the word toiva? Probably wearing weapons is not just a means of seduction or a means of passing, right? But it probably means that we're developing some kind of notion that there is a value in masculine and feminine performance. Yes, Natan.
Is it clear that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov was relating to the word toiva
here? No, but as the Rishonim will say, but then if he's not, then we should ask the same question we ask about the Tanakhama. What does he do with the word toiva? So it seems very unlikely that he's saying it's only prohibited to wear weapons when the purpose of wearing weapons is to allow you to be in a single gendered environment so that you can create sexual assignations. That would be weird.
You could explain it that the original question was just a way of moving on to the answer. in that it wasn't like really a conceptual
you could.
Challenge.
Okay, you could. You could. You could decide for yourself whether you, you know, whether you would be more likely to do that, right? If you were just making an intellectual intellectual judgment. Okay, now here we have you know, we have two happily conflicting rules. One rule is that the halakha generally follows the Tanakhama, and the other rule is that the halakha always follows Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. So, right, that helps us very easily to decide what the halakha is. And accordingly, there is a machloket among Rishonim about whether we pass in like the Tanakhama or we pass in like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. But then again, there are people who say, you know what, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov agrees that there's a prohibition about clothing that is limited to cases where it will lead to sexual assignations. But he thinks that in addition, there's a prohibition against other things, whether or not they lead to, right, they lead to assignations. So passing like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov includes passing like the Tanakhama. And there are versions where the Tanakhama says, where the Tanakhama says, I agree that there's a prohibition against wearing weapons, but only when it leads to, right, to sexual assignations. And there are all sorts of mixing matches. What I want you to get right here, we have a primary text. We have a key choice between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, but the choice is not necessarily exclusive. Each of them can limit the other, and you could end up with a halakha, which is some kind of combination of both. Either leniency, where everything is limited, where everything is limited to leading to assignations, or stringency, where nothing is. Because you could pass like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and say, of course he includes clothing kal v'chomer from weapons, but he rejects the limitation to leading to assignations. Yes, all right.
Why can't you say that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov feels that these cases are also cases which would lead to...
You could. And you could pass in like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, all right, and say that we have a very right say, but he agrees with the limitation, right? It's just implicit, right? He just extends it from clothing to other things, or we could read him radically, right? And then we could say, but you know, right? We could say, but clothing he understands is limited. How you get different prohibitions out of the verse is a challenge. But there, we saw at least one Achron who thinks that the word kol oseela is designed to include multiple. Is designed to tell you that there are more than two prohibitions, because he says the word kol never means just two. So there must be multiple prohibitions. So the Netziv ends up claiming there must be at least four different prohibitions, and that enables you to divide it. So here you all right. So now you know the central text, but the central text opens up lots and lots of avenues, right? Which yield very, very different results in modern cases, and no one has explicitly addressed the question of what is the motive in Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's case. Right, so we know that the Tanakhama, it seems, limits it. It's only prohibited to cases where it will lead to the to'eva various kinds of non-marital sex. But it sounds like, or as Natan's question made clear, that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov must also think it leads to some kind of to'eva. But what is a to'eva? We don't know. It could be mismatches between gender and sex, or it could be confused gender presentation.
But it could also be that a woman going to war with, you know, hundreds of men, he feels, will invariably lead to sexual activity.
And the same about men wearing makeup. Yeah. Could be. Okay. Could be, right? That's right. All those are possible. Right? So I'm not, right? That's why I'm just, I want you to understand that there is a primary text. But the primary text opens up all these avenues, and that there isn't a way to decide which way you're going just based on the primary text. Even just mechanically, it doesn't tell you, right? You can't follow rules that tell you where to end up. Yes, Roger. That's correct. That's correct, right? It seems like the entire concern here is fear of is heterosexual relationships. And that's, right, if we were talking about practical implications, right, so that's good, right, that is a way in which drawing modern implications, right, is huge, because often, often trans people are also people, right, in terms of their biological sex have homoerotic attraction. Right, so that's right. So how you play with those statistics makes an enormous difference, right? Do we say, well, they didn't imagine that there would be any risk of homosexual behavior because they held generally that Jews are not suspected about such things, or right? How you do that is really excellent question. which I don't have an answer to right now. Okay, so how do we do, what happens post Shulchan Aruch? So the Beit Yosef, right, that's Rav Yosef Karo's index cards from which he eventually writes the Shulchan Aruch. Right, so we're on page five. The Beit Yosef says, it makes sense to say that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov agrees to the limit that the Torah only forbids things that leads to toiva. As if not, why does he need to resort to the cases of weapons and accoutrements? Let him say simply that cross-dressing is inherently toiva. Right, so Beit Yosef seems to take a very strong position. Right? He says, even Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov does not think that there is something inherently wrong with men wearing women's clothing. Because if it is, the text would say that. Instead, he has to resort to weapons. What is accomplished by resorting to weapons? He thinks that must lead to toiva, but that seems to be something like Arya's argument. But why is not clear, right? Why is one more, right? And what is the thing of weapons of war, right? What can we think of? Like, what would, there must be all sorts of civil society equivalents of weapons of war that are really, right, I don't know if any of them last anymore, but try and think of like basking in a sexist age. Like what sorts of things you could carry that would be very distinctively in a civilian society the equivalent of weapons of war.
It's also interesting that his language is very specific, not just that a woman cannot, wear a sword, right, but specifically says Yitzela Milchama, but that it's interpreted as being not just the act of going out to war, but even just
could be. Right, and now the problem is this also goes the other way right nowadays, because the question, this Rabbi Yaakov's position came up in the question of whether women could join the Israeli army, and usually the answer would be, well, there's nothing distinctive about weapons in the army, right? That's just an example of clothing, right? So in a society, and if we think that clothing is just socially dependent, so a society where women go to war, that's not an issue at all, right? So just be careful the implications of taking that position. Right? It might get you in hot water about army issues. That's right.
Although it could still be a case where it's an individual, a single woman with men.
Okay. But then the Shulchan Aruch says something which is really hard to square. Right. Right now he's made this entire position, which sounds like he's just going with Rashi, which should lead to the conclusion that it's really not a problem so long as you remain distinctive. Right, as long as your gender is clearly identified, your sex, is clearly identified, right? Why would we care if you put on someone else's garment? Because it's all right. Because it's not gonna lead to an assignation if you can't pass. Right, so we dealt with, what about unisex clothing? Okay, so unisex clothing, we said maybe you can't pass in unisex clothing ordinarily, but here's what the Shulchan Aruch says next. Nonetheless, even if only one item is crossed, right? You're a man wearing the most masculine clothing you can imagine. But you're wearing, a fluffy feather boa. Whatever you think is a classic transgressive behavior in that regard. But no one would think that you're a woman. What you are is a man wearing an article of women's clothing. Shulchan Aruch said, nonetheless, even if only one item is crossed and one's gender remains clearly determinable, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov holds that if it is gender distinctive, it is biblically prohibited. So how does he get from point A to point B? Right? How does he say, on the one hand, that the whole purpose of the prohibition is to prevent you from passing so that you can have a sexual assignation in a single gender, in an otherwise single-gendered place, and also say that it's a biblical prohibition to wear any clothing that is identifiable as belonging to the other sex, even though you yourself remain identified as a person of this sex wearing clothing of the other sex? Yes, David.
Well, the pasuk seems to explicitly say that it has nothing to do with maybe to this, but that it leads to that or the other thing, that it's just inherently a toiva.
Yeah, but the Shulchan Aruch just went out of his way saying it's not inherently a toiva. He says, right, you can't read it that way, yeah. Right? Right, so right after he goes out, right, he makes the statement, right, if that's the position you want, right, you could just take that line out of context in the Shulchan Aruch, and, right, and it could be your banner. And then he says this. I don't have a coherent explanation of this. right? So I'm going to put you right that right. If you want to figure out where halakha should, right, where halakha will end up, all right. Well, a good way to think about the complexity of where halakha would end up is it has to find a way, right? If you want to accept the Shulchan Aruch, which will right, the Beit Yosef, which we'll see, we don't have to do either. But if you want to work through the Beit Yosef, you have to find a way, something that coheres with both of those, and that's really hard. And he doesn't even let you get the rabbinic biblical way out, right? He says it's a biblical violation, and according, right? And he's saying it even in Ezra ben Yaakov. Really, really hard. Okay. When he passes in the Shulchan Aruch, so he says, a woman must not put on men's accoutrements, just putting on, I said, fez, whatever you think a misnefet is. Right? I didn't want to say turban, because that, right, that, is, you know, that seems to be gendered the other way in Israel nowadays, so it wouldn't make any sense to anybody, but I don't think women wear fezes in Israel, even the Dati Lumi women. But okay, wait, but it's not that anybody but Shriners wear fezes. I don't know what the, right? I don't know if it was a good enough term anyway. Or a hat. On her head, sorry, that shouldn't be other. Or dressing in armor, and he moves weapons and puts it right, and has suits of armor instead, right? So right, and the like that are men's clothing in the local place, right? So the Ramah puts it immediately. Don't think, right? Don't think there's anything objectively wrong with women wearing armor. Women can wear armor all they want, as long as it's a place where women wear armor. So like anything else, right? Anything that depends on custom. So the first 50 people are transgressors, and the 51st person is just doing what everyone else does. Right, what happens retroactively to the first 50 is always a challenge. Okay, or shave her head like a man, and a man must not put on women's accoutrements, she's wearing colored clothing. And gold jewelry, that I don't have at least. In a place where only women put those on. And then the Ramah puts in the line about even if there's one piece of clothing that is distinctively of the other sex, you can't wear it. So Ramah puts that in, but the Shulchan Aruch left it out. Maybe they disagree. Maybe the Shulchan Aruch left it out because he said that position in Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, but he paskins like the Tanakama. Maybe the Ramah puts it in because he does paskin like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, or maybe not. Maybe they both paskin like both Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the Tanakama. So all the ambiguities we had resting from the Talmud are transmitted through another right through the next primary bottleneck of halacha. Can't tell who anybody paskins like, and can't tell what they mean by it. Yes, Mark.
It's very interesting. Like, it's not like there's a list saying from the beginning. Now is the list of feminine clothing, is the list of male clothing.
Yeah.
It's all based on societal context, not only. Implicitly, but when Jews are a minority living amongst other groups of people, they're the ones defining whether or not you're violating it. They're the ones that effectively deciding what's feminine clothing.
Well, interesting question, which shows up in all sorts of environments. Like, what happens if in the Jewish community this is female clothing, but in the non-Jewish community this is male clothing? Do we have to change? Or can we say we judge it only by, you know, same as we have with standards of modesty? Do we judge it by the general human community, by the local human community, by the local Jewish community, by the local Orthodox community, by the local Orthodox community that I belong to? Right? Does it matter whether those communities are segregated or come into regular contact? What happens? Right? Maybe we do different things in different spaces. You have to wear different clothing if you go out into the marketplace. If you are in your own community, I don't think this is different than the same problem we have everywhere else with that. Yes, Harvey.
Yeah. So as an example, there are segments of the Jewish community where men aren't supposed to wear wedding rings.
Sure. Right. Wedding rings is an interesting example where you might say that. You might say it's chukot ha-goyim, right? Or you might say, right, that of course we should do that because it depends on the society. Okay, so let's talk about, I want to give you two contemporary, sort of contemporary, 20th century, early and late 20th century responsa, just to begin giving us a sense of what the evidence looks like, and then two older responsa, which are really where much of the practical halachic debate comes from, and then we'll finish. So here are the contemporary tshuvot. Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who was the head of the yeshiva of Slobodka in the early 20th century, back when Slobodka was in Slobodka, before it was in Hebron, and before it was wherever it is now, which is not in Hebron either. So Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who was considered the leading Rosh Yeshiva of his time, wrote to Rabbi Eliezer Prale, who was a rabbi of Elizabeth, New Jersey, and said, right, it said, you know, you sent me your notice in which you claim that it's okay for men to dye their hair to look younger in order to get a job. And you wrote, do I agree that it's okay for men to dye their hair? Now you have to know his background, that men dyeing their hair black was taken as a classic example of wearing makeup. Because men are not supposed to be vain about their appearance. Right? Men are also not supposed to look in mirrors. Right? That's right. All sorts of things which, you know, become socially contingent. Okay. And the Moshe Mordechai Epstein says to Rabbi Perel, I think you got it right. Because he's dyeing his hair in order to get a job. Nobody ever banned things like this just to get a job. So that sounds like we're ending up with a very much intent-focused thing. You know, it's very likely that dyeing your hair increases your possibility of sexual assignations. Right? Probably that is the major market of it, not you'll get a job. And none, right now, it's not likely, that, however, that it has nothing whatsoever to do with passing for women, I don't think. So, right, so on the one hand, it seems like clear that we've ended up with a prohibition that is unrelated to passing. And on the other hand, it seems that we're okay with it as long as it's for some motive that we approve of. So that's yet another you know, track of confusion here. Yes, Maxine.
I guess I'm just wondering also if the fact that, you know, a man dyeing his hair isn't necessarily going to be conspicuous.
We'll get there momentarily. Okay. So number one is, right, we have prohibition, right? We have a prohibition against men dyeing their hair to appear younger, which has nothing to do with passing. And on the other end, we say that this prohibition is perfectly okay if you do it to get a job. Yes, Miriam.
I wonder if it's all across, kind of connected to gender roles in terms of the social structure.
Yeah.
So all the way back to the beginning, where we have men wearing the equipment of war, that is absolutely what cements their power. If you do not have weapons.
So you want to make jobs the equivalent of war?
Actually, yes. Because if the man is the wage earner and income and money, currency of power, yeah, for sure.
I don't buy it in context. I understand, you know, how one could do it in a particular mode of analysis, but I think he just says this, you know, if you read the Tshuva, it's not about. I understand that if you don't dye your hair, then you will lose your job. If you lose your job, then you will feel emasculated. Right? We could do that, but that's not what he says. He says, right? He says you need money. I think that's all he says. We can read it together later. But I think that's all he says. I don't think it's quite that fraught. Okay. So right. So here again, expansion. Yes.
I'm just reading through the Tshuva quickly.
Yeah.
Excerpt. It looks like it's beard hair.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It is beard hair. True. So certainly not going to pass, yeah. Right? Men with black beards do not pass particularly well as women. Good point. Bravo. Yeah. So what is this, right? Where did we come up with, right, this prohibition, which is so much broader on the one hand, right? It can't possibly relate to passing, and so much now, right? And on the other hand, just says it's all about passing. It's all about sexual, right? Right? Really weird. So that's one tshuva. Okay. Another tshuva. Rabbi Tzal Stern. The author of the responsa, which you can decide should either be the Betzel HaChachma and the Shadow of Wisdom, or the Betzel HaChachma, the sharp onion, I've never known which is Tshuva Art. Yes, Gershon.
I also want to
hear
here. I think it's significant in that the alternative is shaving, and to protect against Jewish men shaving their beards.
Interesting sociological claim. Maybe he just doesn't want them to shave. That's an interesting sociological claim. I don't know. That's clever.
Or protect against pulling out gray hair.
Which is a violation of Lo Tilbash Gever, right? So otherwise you'll pull them out, which is even worse. Both very interesting. I don't recall either of those being in the Tshuva as a whole, but they're really, you know, fascinating proposals. And I have to go back and look and see if I missed it. All right, that's excellent. Rabbi Stern says, right, because of this fact, he says, you know what? He says, it's not just prohibited to wear these things, it's also prohibited to have a non-Jew dress you in these things. Now, he misses the opportunity to say that it's lo yehi for women and lo yilbash for men, so maybe only women is prohibited to have non-Jews dress them, but men it would be okay as long as they don't do it actively. He misses that opportunity entirely. Very sad for those of us who want to give a cool, brisker share on the subject, you know, or at least a share with many, many options, but that somebody should have said it. I just said it right now. Now it has a half-life, as Rav Lichtenstein would say. And you can all go find the acronym who thought of it first. But he says, here's the thing. He says, you know, it's prohibited for men to wear women's clothing, and it's prohibited for men to keep wearing women's clothing once non-Jews have dressed them in it. But he said, if you have a non-Jew who dyed your right, who dyed your hair, why would you have to wash it out? There's nothing distinctively female about having black hair. So he invents whole new categories of prohibition. Right? There are kinds of prohibition that are state of prohibitions. You can't be in the condition where this has happened. And there are kind of prohibitions which are just act prohibitions. You can't have this done. You also can't have it done to you by someone else. But having had it done to you by somebody else, you don't have to do anything about it because who cares? So what kind of prohibition is this? And they go, you can't, don't do it, but who cares if you did? Right? That's a whole new universe. Okay, right, we have to figure that out as well, right? What, right? Do we accept that notion that we can make a distinction between the things which are things, right? Within this prohibition, we can just distinguish between things which are act-oriented and things which are result-oriented. Maybe those will line up along the biblical rabbinic axis, maybe not. Okay, we have two other trivot, and then with that we'll finish. Although, if people want to stay and ask questions, as long as there's public interest, I'll take questions from, right, and if people want to come over and ask privately, I'll stay as late as need be for that also. Because I understand that there are lots of really important questions that you might want to ask, which I will probably duck for another 3 weeks. But you're nonetheless welcome to ask. It's fair. Yes, Natan?
I just wanted to mention that dichotomy could already be reflected in the psukim, like in the Lo-Yev versus...
I'd already said that, yeah, but I want an Akron who said it first. Right, that's my... Right, I agree. Yes.
Would there also be, as far as dyeing hair, but also as far as makeup, is it makeup to cover like a scar or?
Sure, we could distinguish, right, as to between makeup that's designed to improve your appearance and makeup that's just designed to restore your appearance. Does it matter what you looked like before? Right, these questions come up in terms of plastic surgery. Right, I think some of you probably know famously that Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva allowing women to have nose jobs, but not at all clear he allows men. All right, so there's a whole interesting thing. One of my students at Harvard, who's now a serious plastic surgeon, wrote her senior thesis on at Harvard nose jobs, and one of her chapters was on the halakha of nose jobs. So I read these trivot together with her. Okay, so last two trivot, right? So it turns out like there are. I don't know of any. There must be, but I don't. I'll tell you offhand. I don't know of any tshuvot. At least I'm not recalling any tshuvot, which raise the question of a specific garment or behavior, and ask the question: is this specific garment or behavior the kind of garment or behavior that is distinctively masculine or feminine, and therefore prohibited to the other sex? Right? There's no conversation about that at all, which is interesting. Right? Nobody asks questions about exactly how distinctively cut do jeans have to be. Right, or robes or anything like that. But what you do have is an ongoing conversation as follows. So the Mari Mintz, this is 15th century Italy, writes the following. This is page 6. Regarding the habit of wearing costumes, both unmarried and married men wear costumes, young and old alike, on Purim. And we discover in the Triva that some of those costumes involve cross-dressing. Right? Men would dress up as women and women would dress up as men on Purim. And they had a somewhat more extended Purim than we do. They had a two-night and one-day Purim for these purposes. So the question was asked is this legal or not? And he says, since it's not intended for the sake of zima, whatever you want to call it, fornication, right? Doesn't use adultery, uses a more general term, but rather for the joy of Purim, it's okay. Men can dress up, right? It's only for a short time anyway. Now, I don't know. Usually, rabbis have a somewhat more... jaundiced view of a short time, and you probably all know, right, it's very popular nowadays that there is a rabbinic discussion which has halachic ramifications for how long men and women are allowed to be secluded with each other. You're not allowed to be secluded with each other, right, in unsupervised spaces, in environment, right, in for the time that it makes it possible to have sex. And guess what? That's not two nights in a day. If that were the case, there would be many, many fewer trivot written about elevators. And you know full well there are many tshuvot written about elevators. So what on earth is going on here? Where all of a sudden somebody says, oh, that prohibition against cross-dressing? Yeah, it's okay. For everyone's just having a great time on Purim. And they're also drunk, so it's nothing. What's going to happen? Right? What could go wrong? Right? Right? An environment with complete gaiety, lots of alcohol, and it's only for 2 nights and a day. So I have no idea what to do with this tshuvot. Absolutely no idea what the mitzvah is. Which the Ramah Paskin's like. Right, this is flat out halacha. Now, there are also all sorts of spoil sports who say, what? What on earth are we talking about? How could this possibly be halacha? Going back to the Reim in the Rebbe Ezra of Metz, all the way back in the 12th century, who says, to wear the opposite gender's clothing, even temporarily and in a joking manner, is forbidden, as scripture did not distinguish between fixed and temporary. I write this because I have seen men wearing women's clothing temporarily as a joke during weddings. No, bad idea. Really, really bad idea. Okay, so there here you have two poles. Right? You have one pole which seems to go back to the notion that that the only thing that's prohibited is things that have the intent of yielding sexual immorality. And all we care about is intent. We don't care in the slightest about results. Because it's hard to imagine. I have this all the time. I'm talking about unisex clothing, right? And I think there have been issues like this, right? Many public Orthodox Purim celebrations for a while, I think it's now being visited, had human beings going around dressed in full body cover animal costumes. And I just like see the dancing bear joining the circle of women and joining the circle of men. Who knows what a bear is? It's not right, never understood like why it was okay halakhically. And yet he says it. We have a primary rabbinic gemara, which could be seen as a fundamental dispute about whether the nature of this is about just about what will lead to immorality, or really about trying to protect essential notions of masculinity and femininity. We have the Shulchan Aruch, who seems like rhetorically to Paskin as strongly as possible that no, it has nothing to do with masculinity and femininity; it only has to do with sex. And then makes a ruling that makes absolutely no sense in terms of that, right? In terms of that rationale, the ruling he makes, he might withdraw from the Shulchan Aruch, but the Ramah then drives it back in. And is this really the kind of halacha we're going to say it's okay for Sephardim but not for Ashkenazim? Yeah, Mark seems happy as a Sephardi. I have issues that go to the core of moral and social issues. It seems to me very hard to just write off and say okay for Sephardi, not okay for Ashkenazim. I think that we should want a more fundamental psak than that. And then we see in the later literature, right? We see that the prohibition has expanded in ways that seem to suggest it can't possibly have anything to do with leading to assignations. And also limited in ways that make no sense unless that is what it is about. And that goes on for, that's a problem that exists for centuries. So it could be I'm missing something obvious, and you'll all tell me, right, Rabbi Clapper, like you've been presenting this if it made no sense, but there's really an obvious solution to this. And somebody will raise their hand, and we'll all know what the halacha is, and the rest of the shiurim can be canceled, basically, on that, in that regard. Or it could be it's really very confusing. And we have a lot of work to do. Yes, Harvey?
Thinking about could social context play a role? Social is a bad word there. What I mean is that the early rabbi in Metz, that's a time we're still very aware of the Crusades, and maybe at times like that, people are tend to get stricter because they're feeling we're being punished for our sins, and therefore we don't want to do anything wrong. They're going to be very strict about halacha in any way that we can.
But I think I'm only giving you sample chavot.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be impossible to find chavot at every period in time, where you'll find both the people are permissive. I picked those two points in time because they happen to be the sources that are quoted by later sources most often. But I don't have the impression, I could be wrong, I don't have the impression that everybody was strict between the Talmud and the 15th century, and all of a sudden Rabbi Yehuda Mintz came up with it. I think that all along you have Purim behaviors, although Italy in the 15th century happened to be a particularly interesting place in terms of, there's another tshuva which Gershon and I had looked at. Seems like something particularly interesting seemed to happen on Purim in the 15th century Italy, but I haven't been able to isolate exactly what. but I think But I don't, it could be, but I don't think so. All right, that's best I can do. Okay, other questions? Yes.
Not necessarily related to this specific topic, but I just wanted to sort of raise the question of whether there's a halachic or a distinction, a category of halachic gender that's different from our socially defined definition of gender.
Could be. I mean, right? You know, I mean, it's easy to come with halachic definitions different than ours. The question is whether there's, you know, how many categories there are, to what extent it maps on, things like that. In the literature that we have seen tonight, I don't think we see any evidence for anything other than a binary, and I don't think we see any evidence that gender is fully disconnected from sex. Although I don't know that you could utterly disprove it, right? Disprove such a position either out of the positions we constructed. I focused only on the prohibition about cross-dressing. I didn't try to construct that other than the beginnings of a discussion in Breishit, where I think it's hard to read Breishit and not see that there is some, you know, there is some essential notion of sex, and that notion of sex relates to something more than what genitals you have. I think it's hard to read Breishit that way, but I didn't really try to make the argument in this shir. That is much more likely to be addressed next week, when we'll talk about the Tzitzili Ezra's position about transition per se, and see what, you know, what there is and isn't there. But even then, you know, we'll raise that next week. But just in case, you know, you all get the idea by now, we're not going to come out next week with total clarity either, or the third week. And then we'll figure out whether by the fourth week there's space to try and, you know, try and develop clarity. I don't have it yet. You know, I thought that it was valuable. And I often think that it's valuable for me to get up in front of a community before I have clarity, so that I can model thinking through Torah, as opposed to, you know, pretending that I'm coming down from Sinai, right, with tablets. And if the process of learning together doesn't change my mind, then I haven't done it right. Right, I'm trying very hard to be very honest that what I'm doing is thinking out loud together with you. And, you know, I have certain ideas, right? But you ask the fellows afterwards, and they'll tell you that even though we looked at these things together, they're not the same as when we looked at them. Mm-hmm. We looked at them together. Some things are the same, and some things are different. I don't know. I don't know yet. I don't know yet. Yes, Mark.
So the emphasis here was genitive directions, but what the fundamental underlying basis is, so you wouldn't have unauthorized sexual relations. But it seems that another way to look at it, without, if you didn't know all of these particular halakhic sources, was there's a lot of other halakhot that prevent you from violating the natural order, right?
Yeah, you could do that, but
maybe grafting not one of them, but, you know, there's a whole bunch of, and it seems like you could easily have put this instead into, like, this is, you know, men to be men, women to be women, that's the natural order, and it's a violation.
You could do that, but interestingly enough, there are no sources doing that. Right, look, I could also construct a position like this, right, because there's a position that men should be men and women should be women, and all we care about is actions, and we just are totally indifferent about, right, in that regard, about appearance. And so, if there were men, right, who wanted to do real feminine things, right, makeup, okay, right, that we're not going to talk this about. But if there are men who, I don't know, want to be, I don't know, what would we think that would be, that men would do that would be like quintessentially female, and, you know, I don't know. Pardon? in America, right, there are men who wanted to be kindergarten teachers, right? They might say, no, that's a violation of the natural order. Or women who want to be professional football players. We could just say that this whole cup, right, that, you know, that's what we bring in natural, we just don't care about appearances. I don't think that's true either. But I just borrowed the data admits of that construction. I think it's a highly implausible construction. So I think one has to admit that in the context of cross-dressing, the absence of that sort of rhetoric, and not only the existence of powerful statements against it, is really interesting. And yet, you know, it would have been so easy if we addressed it, and therefore, and made the halacha perfectly clear in ways, right? The halacha doesn't go that way. The halacha keeps expanding in ways that seem only to make sense if we thought that way. right? So that in the 20th and 21st century, right, it's easy for people who want to, right, who believe things like that, to say that the halakha obviously supports this, because look, there are halakhot that make no sense, unless you have a notion like this. And that, right, that's a complicated question, because it's true. Right? Why would there be halakha that you can't wear one, right, one article, a man can't wear one article of feminine clothing while remaining wholly distinctive as a male, unless you have some kind of notion, right, along what you're saying? Right? I think that's true. And that's why I don't have a direction yet. I'm just putting the data out so we can all think about it. Okay, this seems like a good time to break up the public session. Thank you very, very much, and I look forward, I hope, to seeing all of you and all your friends next week. Yeah.
Question or comment?